The following program is a presentation of Grace Communion International and Grace Communion Seminary, and is made possible by generous donations from viewers like you. On this episode of You're Included, Dr. Steve McVeigh, president and founder of Grace Walk Ministries, emphasizes the importance of an accurate understanding of the cross and how it affects our view of the whole being of God. Our host is Dr. Michael Morrison.
Steve, thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Glad to be back with you.
Last time we were talking about the sacrifice of Jesus, and you were commenting that many people view this sacrifice as God punishing Jesus. And you objected strongly to that notion. And I thought maybe you could tell us a little bit today about why you think that's so important that people have an accurate understanding of what was going on there in the crucifixion of Jesus.
Well, I think that it is important, Mike, because how we understand what happened at the cross will affect our view of the Father and who He is. I know that in my own tradition, growing up for a long time, I didn't have any problem connecting to the idea of being intimate with Jesus because of what Jesus did for me. But when it came to the Father, I had a different understanding because what my view was, and I think it's a common view, is that Jesus took the punishment from the Father so that the Father wouldn't punish me. So it's inevitable that if that's our view, we're going to think that Jesus is like the loving one, and the Father is the stern, harsh one who is exacting and who insists on the books being balanced. It's almost like an angry father and a mother who's trying to keep the dad from getting onto the children, you know? And that's kind of how I saw it. Like Jesus was the loving one and the Father was the angry one. And when we look at the cross, if we see it that way, through the lens of what's called penal substitution, that Jesus was the substitute who took our punishment from God the Father so that the Father wouldn't punish us, how will we ever experience a sense of intimacy with the Father? Now, that's very out of line with what Jesus came for. I mean, Paul the Apostle told us about Jesus that He is the exact representation of the Father. So just as Jesus the Son is loving, so is God the Father and God the Spirit are equally as loving. Now, I'm not saying that there wasn't a substitution there. Jesus did die on the cross in our place. He was our substitute. But what He did was He drew in the penalty of sin into Himself. The wages of sin is death. Now, let me back up to the Garden of Eden. God didn't say to Adam and Eve, if you eat from that tree of the knowledge of good and evil, I'll kill you. He didn't say that. He said, if you eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, you'll die. He didn't say, I'll kill you. He said, you'll die. And in the same way, coming back to the New Testament, it wasn't God that punished Jesus. It was sin that punished Jesus. Another word for punishment is the word penalty. It's the same Greek word. It's punishment, it's penalty. The penalty for sin was death. What did Jesus do at the cross? God the Father was in the Son, empowered by the Spirit, and our triune God drew the penalty, the payment, the wages, the punishment that sin brings into Himself and away from us so that we wouldn't have to be punished by sin, but we would be delivered from sin's punishment. And He took it into Himself and died for us so that we could be free. Why is it important to see it that way? It's important because, again, if we think God the Father is angry, then Jesus didn't do a very good job of letting us know what He was like. Because when Jesus came here, He said, if you've seen me, you've seen the Father. Study the Gospels. You don't find Jesus portraying for us a God who's angry with us about our sin. To the contrary, every time you see Jesus encountering people in sin, He extends grace and love and mercy and forgiveness because that's the Father. Even in the story of the prodigal, story that Jesus told. We call it the story of the prodigal, but it's really not the story of the prodigal. It's the story of the Father. That story wasn't told to show us something about sinning people, or for that matter, even self-righteous people, the older brother. That story was told to teach us something about our Father. And what He told us in that story is this. He told us through the illustration of the younger brother, the prodigal, who came back with his decision to rededicate himself and promise his father that if he'd forgive him, you know, he'd do better, he'd serve more, he'd be a better. But the Father didn't even let him give his speech. I spent my life rededicating myself to God the Father, promising Him I'd do better, I'd try harder. Well, Jesus was in that story of the prodigal. You know, the boy tries to give the speech, but the Father interrupts him and doesn't let him give it. Then you've got the older brother who's self-righteous. You've got the unrighteous on the one hand and the self-righteous on the other hand who says, look, all these many years I've served you and I've never violated or transgressed your commandments. And the father says, son, what do you mean? All that I have is yours. What do you mean I won't give you a party because all I have is yours? Both of those boys missed the point because the one boy, the younger, the prodigal, thought that he would be rejected because of his misbehavior. The other thought he should be accepted and honored because of his good behavior. And the father was trying to say to them both, you don't get it. It's not about you and your behavior. It's about me and how much I love you independent of anything you do or don't do. It's about me. And so it is with our Heavenly Father. He wants us to see, and that's what Jesus came to reveal, is that he loves us unconditionally, unilaterally if need be. Now, obviously, those of us who are believers love him, but why do we love him? We love because he first loved us. Even that is a reciprocal response to his love for us. It's all about our concept of God the Father. He's got a bad rap because of the religious world. In spite of all Jesus did to give us clarity on it, the religious world has clouded it.
For a long time, my concept of God the Father was like Lincoln in the Lincoln Memorial, sitting in this huge throne, stone, impassive, stern, and wasn't really the sort of God that I wanted to spend eternity with.
Exactly. Back to the story of the father in Luke chapter 15. You don't see some austere, dignified father there. In fact, here, I love it. You see a picture of a father who sees a son at the distance, and he stands up, and he's wearing these long, flowing, dignified garments, you know, that they wear and still in that part of the world, and he pulls those garments up high so he can run, because he can't run with them down at his feet. He pulls them up high above his knees so that he can run, and he takes off running. Now, understand, nobody in that part of the world till today sees their dad's naked legs. Here's the key. That's a shame. It's a disgrace. That father didn't care. Here's what he did. He pulled the robes up and he ran, acting in an undignified way, but he was acting out of passionate love, even willing for those who were witnessing that scene, who might have seen it, to cause them to look away from the boy covered in the filth of the pig pen and look to the father and say, what is he doing? He's running naked down the street because he had pulled his robes up above his legs. They'd never seen that. But the kind of love that father had for the boy, he was willing to take the shame off of the boy and bring it on to himself if need be, because he wasn't interested in protecting his reputation. He was interested in embracing and receiving his son back. That Jesus wanted us to see is the kind of father you have. He's passionate. He'll run down the street with his robe pulled up above his knees if necessary. He'll take the shame on himself to rescue you from your shame. Different picture than the God sitting in the judge's chair that we've imagined, huh? Totally different picture.
Definitely.
And the beauty of it is about this younger and older son in Luke 15, and I didn't plan to say so much about this chapter, but another point comes to mind. The older boy, there's your religious church going boy. There's your believer. Yeah, the father says, I love you, but I love this one the same. But the privileges were extended to both equally. Equally. Now both were missing out on experiencing the abundant life their father provided for them. One because of his unrighteousness, the other because of his self-righteousness. But the story in my mind there illustrates that sometimes it's easier for an unrighteous person to enter in and experience grace than it is a self-righteous person. And notice that self-righteous brother in Luke 15, when the unbelieving son, if I can use that word, began to believe and accepted his father's acceptance and came into the party, the older boy got all bent out of shape about it. He didn't like that at all.
Yeah, the younger son had reached a bottom.
That's right.
He knew.
That's right.
Where his works ended up.
That's right. And the religious son didn't want the younger one to be included, but he was. And the church world today doesn't want everybody to be included. We just want us to be included. After all, we go to church. We read our Bible every day.
We're the ones that have been cleaned up.
We've been cleaned up. That's right. We're not. To quote that older brother, look, I've served you all these many years. I've never violated or transgressed your commandments in any way. What gives with you bringing this guy and telling me he's as accepted as I am? I've behaved a lot better than he. Yeah. And the father's saying, are you beginning to get it? It's not about your behavior. I don't love because of how good you are. I love because of how good I am. We're all included. Now, if you can live in the pig pen, in the penitentiary of the pig pen, Or like that older boy, you can live in the penitentiary of your performance. But both live outside the pleasure of the grace of God. And the thing that we've talked in the last program about this shift in my own mind, Mike, one of the things that, and it's what you guys here at Grace Communion are all about, and it's what this program is all about. One thing that shifted in my own mind is the understanding that we are all included. That what Jesus did, he didn't just do for good boys, so to speak. And I don't mean that literally. I say that tongue in cheek, because that's how a lot of folks would see, you know, church going spirit leaders. But he did that for everybody. We all do indeed stand on equal ground at the foot of the cross. And we all need his grace the same. And thank God it's been poured out all of us the same. Those of us that believe it, enjoy it. We're in the party dancing and eating barbecue. Those that don't are standing out in the dark in the hell of their own choice. But don't act like they're out there in a hell because there's something left for God to do. He's done everything. They're out there because of their own pride and stubbornness.
So you would say a person that's an atheist, see, even some of these militant atheists, their sins are already forgiven?
Absolutely. That's the gospel. Let me tell you a story if I can. I've told this story for 20 years, but I've used a different application. I want to tell it for the sake of those who are familiar with my ministry and heard it, and for those that aren't. But those who've heard my ministry are going to go, whoa, now he's telling that story differently now. He's making a different application. This story actually started, I think, with Bill Bright, the founder of Campus Crusade for Christ, largest mission sending agency in the world. Bill Bright used to tell about a guy named Mr. Yates out in Texas that had a farm. This was in the Depression days, right before the Depression struck. Mr. Yates was trying to eke out a living, and the Depression struck, and he fell behind on his farm payments. And one day, a representative from the mortgage company came to him, and he said, "You're behind on your payments. You got to make your payment on the farm, or we'll evict you. We'll foreclose and evict you." Yates said, "I can't make my payment." The guy said, "You're going to have to pay, or you're going to be evicted." And Yates said, I don't know. The guy said, "Well, in 30 days, we're going to file a dispossessory notice and get you off the property." The day started winding down. Yates didn't know what he was going to do. One day he heard a knock at the door, and he opened it up. It was a man from an oil company. And the guy said, "We're doing some wildcat drilling out here. We wanted to see if you'd let us drill on your property. We have reason to think there may be oil here." Yates said, "Go ahead." He's thinking in his mind, "I've lost it all anyway. I don't have a penny." They come onto his property the next day, and they sink a drill into the ground, and bang, they hit a gusher. 80,000 barrels, 85,000 barrels of oil a day come gushing up out of that well. Bang, instantly, Mr. Yates has millions of dollars in cash accessible to him. Now, here's the question. At what point did Mr. Yates become a millionaire? The answer is, he became a millionaire on the day he bought the farm. Then why was he living like a pauper? Because he didn't know what he had. Now, the way I used to make that application is I would say, "You see, you always have had riches in Jesus since the day you've been saved, since the day you trusted Christ, since the day you prayed and believed on him. But it's by believing it now that you experience it." But here's where that falls short, and here's where I've changed my story. I don't say anymore, Mike, that we became millionaires on the day we trusted Christ. That was the day we struck oil. We became millionaires on the day Jesus died. For whom did Jesus die? I happen to believe the Bible teaches he died for everybody. We're all included.
Right.
So if everybody's included, then the benefits of the finished work of Christ at the cross belong to everybody. Then why is everybody not living out of that spiritual wealth? It's one of two reasons. Either they don't know it or they don't believe it. But it doesn't change the reality. The day they struck oil on Yates' property and he began to make withdrawals, you know, cash the checks, so to speak, he began to live like a millionaire. But objectively, he'd been a millionaire all along. It only became a subjective experience when he cashed the check. And there you go. The objective work of Jesus for everybody. If he died for everybody, then what he did for everybody is true of everybody, if that makes sense. But does it matter then whether we believe or not believe? Of course, it makes all the difference in the world because it's by believing that we cash the check and live out of the wealth that's ours in him. But it doesn't change the reality of what he did, even if we don't believe. We're living like paupers if we don't believe, but we're not paupers. We just don't know. Did I tell that in a way that makes sense?
I think so.
Yeah.
It reminded me of the story about the acres of diamonds.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
People had diamonds in their field, didn't know it. It was theirs. They just didn't know the value.
That's right. That's right. I remember that book from years ago. That's it. And so it is what Jesus did. He didn't do for just a few of us. He did for everybody. And so I don't say to an unbeliever, if you'll just pray and ask Jesus into your heart, he'll forgive your sin. That implies there's something left undone. That implies that what Jesus should have said at the cross was, okay, your move. I've done my part, now it's your move. What are you going to do? The game comes to a standstill until you make your move. No, no, no. Jesus said, game over, it's finished, you're in. It's game over. Fold the board up, put it up. Game done. Now, it's finished. If you don't want to believe it, I don't mean you, but if you don't want to believe it, well, okay. Live like a pauper then.
So now all we're doing is telling a story of something that's already been done.
That's the gospel. That's why it's good news. As I said in the last program, it's not a potential gospel, like God's done something and now he's waiting for you to do something. He's done it and it's finished. There's nothing left. But now, you can live in that reality or you can live under the lie. Again, back to the garden. You can live under the lie that befell Adam and Eve and get all this, hold on to all this distorted, skewed thinking about your father and who he is and what he's going to be like. You know, you can get all this messed up thinking in your head and live outside the pleasure of it, but it is what, you can go right off into hell clinging to your lies if you want to, but there's nothing left for the father to do. He's done it all.
A hell of your own making.
A hell of your own making and a hell of your own choosing. God's, you know, people say, well, did God sending people to hell? You're already in hell if you're not believing this good news. Hell is not the absence of God. Let's throw that snake on the table, since we're talking about some things here. Hell is not even the absence of God. Ask anybody in the Eastern Church. We in the Western world have the idea that hell means God's checked out and gone home. No. Do we understand to believe where the Bible tells us that all things that exist consist by him? In other words, everything that holds together because he's there holding it together. So if hell itself was the absence of God, then hell would implode or explode. It would cease to exist. No, far from it. Hell itself is not the absence of God. I believe, and this is another discussion, and it may open a can of worms, but I believe hell itself is the presence, the inescapable presence of the love of God. And those who loathe and detest it find it to be hellacious. But those of us who receive it find it to be heavenly. I mean, what did James say? He said, if you love your enemy, it seems to them like you're doing what? You're heaping coals of fire on their head.
So it's the same reality, but a different perception.
Absolutely. And again, I'm not making this stuff up as I go. I'm not smart enough to do that. I've studied it and read it. I can tell you, outside our Western world, the Greek church right now, the church in the eastern part of the world, they get this. You and I and the people watching us in this part of the world, we've been so influenced by Augustinian theology and not just theologians, but even people like Dante and others about what hell is and is not, that we've got it all scrambled in our brains. But I think the Eastern Church has a beat on this thing, that God is love. So if I can say it this way, any and everything that can be understood about God must come to love as its resting place, or we haven't gone far enough, because God is love.
Mm.
And everything and anything that we're going to connect to him has to be an expression of that love, or we've not gone far enough in our understanding to get to the root of it.
I wanted to get back to the crucifixion of Jesus. What then was its role? What changed for all humanity? Was it just a forgiveness of sins, or was there something
deeper than
that?
So much changed. No, forgiveness of sins wasn't even the main thing. Forgiveness of sins was the B team. That was the secondary issue. There had to be this forgiveness of sins thing so that the main event could take place. And the main event that took place was we received life. I give you an example, a few verses, John 3:16. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son, that whoever believes in him shouldn't perish, but should have everlasting forgiveness. No, life. John 10:10, I've come so that you might have forgiveness and have it more abundantly. No, life. All the verses about life. He's come so that we can have life, so that we can have life, 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 not forgiveness. What happened at the cross? Here it is. And I'm going to be succinct, and people watching will just have to dig this out for themselves and study this. Look at all these other programs on Your Included. You've got them archived. I learned a lot watching the archived programs right here on this, and I'm not saying that because I'm sitting here. It's the truth. There's a lot of good stuff on here. Here's what happened. What the first Adam did was wrap us all up into himself as the federal head and brought humanity down into this place of sin. We were doomed and damned. We were condemned, not by God, by sin. That's humanity. Jesus comes along. The Father, Son, and Spirit said, well, that's not going to stand. We're not going to let Adam get the final say on all this. So here's the incarnation. Jesus comes, the last Adam. And he did, in a sense, like the first Adam did, he was our federal head. And he wrapped us all up in himself, all of us, everybody that had been in Adam. In fact, Paul said what Jesus did was much more than what Adam did. He uses that phrase more than once, much more. He wrapped us all up into himself, and the Adam's race went to the cross with Jesus and died with Jesus and was buried with Jesus. And then, and this is pivotal, this is it, this is the good news, when Jesus came up out of the grave, a new species was raised up with him. Those in Christ, if anyone's in Christ, he's a new creature, species, a new species. You say, but, well, you mean, well, who do you think died with Jesus? As a Calvinist, I used to say, well, only the elect, only those who were chosen. But listen to this, 2 Corinthians 5:14. This is out of the Bible. Let me hold it up where people can see I'm reading. For the love of Christ controls us, having concluded this, that one died for all, therefore all died. Who's the one that died for all? Jesus. Therefore, who did he die for? Everybody. He tasted death for every man. Therefore, all died. We all died with Jesus. We were all buried with Jesus. But when Jesus came up out of the grave, a new species came into existence, something new. And the gospel now is, here's what the cross did. The cross provided forgiveness of sin. We don't have to tell people he'll forgive your sin. He has. The cross has, Jesus is the elect man, the elect one. He is a man. There's a God-man in heaven today. He's the elect man in whom we all reside. And therefore, we were all elect. We were all chosen. We were all made holy. And what does holy mean? If you look it up, the word means set apart. You see, in the evangelical church world, we think, well, if I say he's holy, oh, so-and-so over here, he's holy. People think, oh, that means he lives a squeaky clean life. No, no, no. They don't mind calling this book a holy Bible. That Bible doesn't live anyway. They don't mind calling God's temple the holy temple. It just means set apart. In that sense, he's called us all and set us all apart, made us holy. Righteous, there's another one. You use the word righteous, and certainly one understanding of the word has to do with living a certain lifestyle. But now wait, if you look up in Strong's dictionary, for instance, the Greek word righteous, one definition is living your life based on a certain religious or moral code. Now we know good and well that's not what the New Testament tells us our righteousness is. The other is righteousness is being made in a right standing with God. Ding, 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 ding. There's the one. There it is. It might be number two on the list, but it's the one we better go to.
I can see that in there.
Yeah, we better go to that one because we know it's not about living a moral code. So there it is. So we've all been made right with God. We've been reconciled. So much happened at the cross. We've been joined into union. There's the big one. We've been joined into union with him again. So the obvious question then people ask me sometimes is, Steve, you sound like a universalist. Are you saying everybody drops dead, wakes up in heaven? No, I'm not saying that.
Well, you'd already talked about hell.
That's right. I did, didn't I? That's right. I've already talked about hell. No, no. If I can paraphrase him, and I hate to try to paraphrase someone as eloquent as Robert Capon, but Robert Capon, the theologian and author, said, on the last day, nobody goes to hell because of sin, because that sin issue has been dealt with. He said, now, if you get to Judgment Day, and he too is a literary speaker, he says, if you get to Judgment Day and face God and say, I won't accept your acceptance, well, then you can just go to hell. He says, but don't act like it's because of sin, because sin has been dealt with in totality by the finished work of Jesus. So no, I'm not saying everybody's instantly in, whether they believe or not. I think that faith in Christ is essential. Otherwise, back for the umpteenth time to the older brother, we'll stand out in the outer darkness if we don't believe. But it's not because God's locked us outside or won't let us in. It's because of our own stubbornness and pride.
You had described how Jesus dying on the cross, God was really in Jesus reconciling us.
Mm-hmm.
But yet the scriptures say that Jesus on the cross said, my God, why have you forsaken me?
I'm so glad you asked that. I'm glad you asked that because that's one of the biggest misunderstandings in the modern church. You nailed it. You said Jesus asked the question. What did God answer in that gospel, in the Gospels? What was the answer God gave? He didn't, did he? He didn't give an answer. So people looking at God through that wrong lens assume God, the Father, forsook his son Jesus. The answer is he didn't forsake his son. That was the cry of Jesus when he became sin for us. And if he had heard the answer right then and there, God would have said, I haven't forsaken you. You say, how do you know? I'll prove it. Psalm 22. Psalm 22 is the messianic psalm from which that verse, that cry of Jesus came. First verse, Psalm 22, the messianic psalm. My God, why have you forsaken me? You can go on down and read that psalm, and bit by bit, you see it's talking about the cross, right down to them casting lots for his garments, everything. It's describing the cross. But if you go down to verse 24 in Psalm 22, you get the answer to the question. It's not recorded in the gospel, but it is in Psalms. Psalm 22, verse 1, why have you forsaken me? Verse 24, he has not despised nor abhorred the affliction of the afflicted, nor has he hidden his face for him. But when he cried to him for help, he heard. Now, here's the neat thing. All the Jews knew these psalms. If I say to you, anybody in America, I don't care how old you are, if I say to you, if you're old enough, I say, plop, plop, fizz, fizz. You know the rest. What is it?
I'm not old enough.
You don't know? I bet those watching know. Okay, how about this?
Oh, is that Alka-Seltzer?
Alka-Seltzer.
Okay. All right.
Okay, now I'm going to press you because you got to know. Plop, plop, fizz, fizz. What's the rest of the jingle? Oh, what a relief it is.
Relief.
There you go. Okay. All right, let's try another one. Let me get down to your level.
When I was a kid, we didn't have TV.
Oh, so you didn't have TV. Well, then you certainly won't know this one. Winston tastes good like a
cigarette should.
You didn't even have TV, and you know that, you old heathen. All right, it was the same way with the Psalms. When people standing around the cross heard the first line of that psalm, they knew the rest of it. So when Jesus cried out, my God, why have you forsaken me? Every self-respecting Jew standing there knew the rest of it. And the answer was, he has not forsaken him or turned his face on him. But here we are 20 centuries later saying, see, he asked the question, why did God forsake him? God must have forsook him. We've missed the point. No, he did not forsake him. He was right there in him and with him the whole time.
And we see in the resurrection that he didn't forsake him.
That's right. The Father never forsook the Son. People say, well, they were fragmented. Are you kidding? Deity being fragmented? Why not? The Godhead would have ceased to exist. Father, Son, and Spirit have always been in that perichoresis, in that circle of love, and it's never wavered for one moment, even at the cross. And which is encouraging to us, because like Jesus, when we cry out, why have you forsaken me? We can know God says, I haven't. I'm with you.
And he will never forsake us.
And he'll never forsake us.
You've been watching You're Included, a production of Grace Communion International.